Hello.
Hello.
Dave's out in the field again. He's in the field. Mate. Dave, how are you? Welcome to everyone. Just give it a few seconds for everyone to just come online, things like that.
I'm very good. How are you?
Waiting. Yeah, I'm really good, mate. Really good. It's been a good week. It has flown by. Seriously, I thought it was about Thursday or something. And
I'm
you're scanning around at an empty field.
Yeah, I mean, if I open the door, it's blowing a hoolie out there. So I'm in the van.
What have you been up to, mate? What have you been up to?
So I'm here with...
Oh, he is the main man. Now, tell me, are you privately, out of your own pocket, in your own time, actually teaching an old dog new tricks?
Yes, and the old dog is me. Yes, Staffordshire countryside with two retired Met police dog handlers and instructors.
Yeah.
Teaching Finn a new skill, but also refreshing some of my skills and also looking at the outside world and how they... I mean, the guy here, Rob Hewins, he's a retired Met PC dog handler and instructor, but he's a doctor. Dr. Rob Hewins. He's taken that his level of understanding and learning that far that he now has a doctorate in all sorts of animal behavior. So
I mean, this is amazing. And before we just bring on Nigel Lang, who is part of the Southwest Ambulance Service, and he's with the Air Ambulance. I've known him for a few years. We've done a few things together. So we're going to bring him on in a little bit. But Dave, just a little bit more on that, because clearly Finn is able to track. And I keep forgetting, was he firearms? I don't think he was firearms.
He was firearms support.
Yeah. And so what are you actually, what's he learning new that you didn't know before?
When Finn was searching for things, he was normally searching for people, and now and then we would ask him to search for things that people had thrown away. So it's human scent, but and normally when people discard things, they're like big jumpers or balaclavas or rucksacks, so the scent's quite big. But now we're asking him to look for tiny droplets of, in this instance it was gun oil, but you can use clove or you can use anything really that's got a scent. And we're asking him to go into minute detail with his searching. And what that does is for him, and these searches are small. They're over a much smaller area, you know, a small part of a building or a small part of a route. And what it does is it keeps his mind incredibly active. He's getting a little bit of exercise, which his body needs, because he is slowing down, bless him. But it keeps this so active that he finishes his day here and he's the happiest and most tired dog there is, but he's had a wonderful time.
So you're learning stuff as well, or you're basically getting you're expanding your sort of the information coming in so you can compare it with what you're doing. And because I know with the firearms units in Devon and Cornwall, I know with used to be a training center there when I was when I was being instructed there, and we would get students from all over the force area, and they would bring nuggets of information which we would then assess, look at, and then take on if necessary. I mean, it's all a national course and things, but you do get these local ideas. And going back to that one then, because you've got USB cards and all that, so things such as money laundering, paedophilia, that side of things, where these tiny little cards, memory cards, have been secreted in various areas. And I know, again, in Devon and Cornwall, a guy, a dog handler, went over to America in his own, with his own, on his holiday, so to speak, with his own money. And then it was only when the force realized how useful it was that they refunded him his fees, because it's incredible.
Cornwall really spearheaded that in the UK. They were the first to bring it here, and they had the first courses. So, sometimes you do need to step outside of what your sort of base is and see what other people are doing. And coming on a course like this with Rob and Karen has been brilliant.
Oh, it is amazing. And then, so what about the other people that are with you? I bet they're sort of thinking, blimey, we've got an actually real dog handler with us, with a hero dog.
Finn's had his picture taken with everybody. Everybody knows who Finn is. it's been lovely. And of course, they're from all the four corners of the country. So they bring what they're doing locally in, and it's such an amazing sort of learning platform, and you get to share all this information. It's absolutely brilliant.
Well, before we go on to something as heroic as the air ambulance and stuff like that, which is all this side of stuff, isn't it? It's all this. This is it. I mean, these were photographs now that I took with these, and these were just plonked next to you, and it was just amazing. I took this photograph. I don't think with this one there was much they could do for them. This was a off-roader motorbike. It just literally had a cardiac and fell over off his bike. So if, like his friend said, my God, you know, he certainly died doing what he enjoyed, because that was his hobby. But there was something before we go into this. I've got a much more important thing, because I tried to embarrass my wife. We'd been married for, I had to ask her the other day, I think it was 27 years. No, wow. I've known her for 27 years. I think we've been married, I don't know. She's as bad as me, okay? But I was in the loft and we were clearing a load of stuff out, and I even got a skip. And I thought I was going to have to wait until she went to her mum's house before I could get rid of the stuff. But she's been really good. And I get an old newspaper of when she was Miss Torbay, right? Now, she's mortally embarrassed every time I mention this. And if she was listening to this on her phone outside, she'd be bursting the door open saying, don't do it, don't do it. She's really embarrassed, right? So my dad married a Hollywood actress called Ann Todd, and I married Miss Torbay. Yes. So, right, now there's a guy here called Jim Davison, right? You may recognise him as Jim Davison. He's making a bit of a comeback, actually, on his thing. And right, so here we go. Yeah. Right, so this is, right? This is my wife, right? And I'm thinking...
Oh, my God!
And I'm thinking, well, you know, that's fine. Now, this is all very nice. Him. He's, and then, oh, that's inappropriate. She's actually on his lap now. Now, I'm not sure that would be, you know... And now, look where her hand is. I've had to have a word with her. I thought that was really that
wow.
was really
Harry, you've been punching above your weight for far too long.
So it was great, but there's memories. I mean, that would have been a 1992 paper, and when it listed her, it said it actually gave and Rebecca Harding vital statistics are, and it says something like 34, 24, 31. Can you imagine nowadays? Right. Oh my God. So I think it's about time, don't you?
I do, think it's mate. About I can't time. Believe we've got a guest. We haven't had a guest for weeks.
I know. No, I know. They've been avoiding us like the plague. No, I have got a couple in the, because the thing is, when we have someone on aeroplanes and things, we tend to concentrate on aeroplanes, and we love aeroplanes, but we've got to make sure that it doesn't just be aeroplanes, you know? So I've got a whole list of people I'd love to have on. But shall we introduce Nigel Lang? Nigel Lang, welcome. How are you?
Hi, Nigel.
Hi, guys.
Mate, I'm so pleased to have you here, because I know, I've known you for a few years now through Learn to Live, haven't I really?
But I want to probably a good 10 years, I think.
Maybe it is. Apparently. It will have, and we haven't changed a bit. Dave's got really old and knackered, but we've been all right.
My hair is as good as it was then.
so you're obviously your Devonair ambulance at the moment, and you are ultimately as a copper, and Dave will know, he'll have experienced exactly the same stuff. Is you are heroes from the sky, and suddenly everything is all right. And do you know what? Generally, there's not a lot you can do when people have been killed at the scene. All right, there is something you can do, but generally, the rule of thumb for me was if there was an iota bit of life at the scene when you guys turned up, I knew generally they were going to be all right. It's just incredible stuff you did. But let's start from the beginning. Where were you? Are you a Devon boy?
I'm a Somerset boy.
Somerset. Yeah. Crossed the border, like me. I went from Cornwall and crossed the border into Devon. Yeah. But right. So how did it all start? What did you want to be when you were a kid?
So I wanted to be a policeman.
Did you?
No, well done. You made a good choice.
I don't think I was good enough.
So you were probably too clever for us. You knew lots. Yeah. You could learn lots of long words and stuff, you know. Yeah. So you wanted to be a copper. So what changed that? So, at what point did that change?
I think I grew up a bit. And
we never did.
I just wanted to do things which were unrealistic, really, like, you know, make a living out of going canoeing and things like that. So that didn't really last, as you can imagine. It's not the sort of thing that pays your mortgage. So, so I eventually got around to retraining. I joined West Country Ambulance Service nearly 20 years ago, and did my basic training with them, and a lot has changed over that time. I spent about 7 or 8 years working on the road on ambulances. And since then I've been lucky enough to be working for, as you say, Devonair Ambulance. There it is.
I mean, again, this was one I'd been to, and again, they survived, they were fine. I wouldn't put it on there otherwise, and it just shows how close you can get to. But so how did you actually get into that department? Because surely to coin an unpopular, inappropriate phrase, it's dead men's shoes, they would call it in the police, if there's those jobs that people tend to stay with, don't they? But what was the situation with you?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. But back when I joined, luckily, the paramedics were on for a fixed term. So 2 or 3 years fixed term, then you came off. I've been very lucky throughout my career. And it continued because towards the end of my time, things changed, and we no longer had fixed term, because there's a big investment in our training and our development.
Yeah,
it's very expensive, and for us to rotate through costs a lot of money, and so. In fact, that stopped, and as long as you know you can continue to do the work, you know, and you're fit enough and able enough to do the work, then we stay on. And so I've been very lucky. I've been on 11 years.
Yeah. Wow. That's a phenomenon.
So the helicopters are run by a charity, but you still work for the ambulance service. Is that right?
No, I work. No. So it's different right across the country.
Right.
So there's no set model for the way the air ambulances work. And things have changed and they've developed over the 28 years that Devonair Ambulance has been around. So now I work directly for Devonair Ambulance.
Oh, yes, it changed, didn't it? What was the reasons for that?
So I think that one of the great things about being independent is the very fact that you can do what you think is right for the role in which you're trying to, you know, work and the service you're trying to deliver. When you are governed by and run by a very big organisation, and that you're only a very small part of that, then you're not really a priority.
Right.
Being completely independent, then you are essentially, you know, masters of your own destiny.
And
all your focus is on what you do. So I think that was the main driver.
I mean, it's an enormous charity. I mean, I was looking at the facts and figures. I mean, it truly... The support that you have from the public out there is absolutely massive. And, of course, you couldn't do it without them. But, you know, you've been doing it for 11 years. Is that right?
So I have been. The charity has been operational for 28 years. And, of course, you know, it's changed beyond all recognition. When the first flight took place the helicopter was flying for a maximum of, I think it was five days a week.
Right.
You know, there are stories whereby the crew didn't know whether there was enough funds in the accounts to pay for the fuel.
No.
Now, that was right back at the very beginning. And, you know, everything has to start somewhere. And what's happened is that you're right, Dave. You know, we are supported in Devon so well. And, you know, Harry, you know, thanks for the hero analogy. But, you know, I know it's going to sound a bit corny, but truly the absolute heroes are the people that fund the service.
Yeah.
You know, and that's people that are, you know, taking part in charitable events, and they are paying to the lottery, and they are leaving legacies, but also the people that are volunteers. We've got hundreds of volunteers, and without those people, we wouldn't exist. And so, it's all about perspective. For me, they are the heroes.
I mean, yeah, they literally are saving lives. And because, and in a way, it's like the lifeboat. I know people in the lifeboat, and they say, oh, the government should be paying for this. And they say, no, don't, because the government, if they paid for it, they'd cut us and slash the budgets, and we'd be, you know, we'd be in old Sea Kings now still, perhaps, or something. I don't know. But although they were pretty good. But yeah, so at least with private, you can really, people can see what they're actually contributing to as well. They can really see the effects of it. And yeah, I mean, it's just a phenomenal thing. So you were lucky to get on it. Is there like a specific training course initially? There must be. Or do you go straight on to the helicopter and they sort of, you get a tutor as such? What happens?
Yeah, and again, all of that has changed. So when I joined, the training course was 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So bearing in mind, I was already a paramedic. And now my training course was about working on helicopters. And so 2 weeks is a ridiculously short training course to work on a helicopter.
Yeah.
And so I look at my training being several years, you know.
Yeah.
My first year of working on HEMS was crazy.
I bet it was.
You know, I thought there was an awful lot to take on board. The guys that join us now, the most recent guys that have joined us, have had to take on board so much more than what I had to take on when I first joined. Because what we've done is the service has developed beyond all recognition from a clinical perspective as well. So not only are they having to take on the aviation side of things,
which,
you know, does take a long time. You can't shortcut experience, but the clinical side of things is just changed hugely. And just their basic induction was 2 or 3 months, followed by an additional 3 months, I think it was. You know, just, you know, observing and
supervisory.
And then of course, you know, you work with an experienced operator.
Now, Dave, I'll be interested. Go on, Dave. No, I was interested in you, because when I joined the armed response section like 25 years ago, the course was like 5 or 6 weeks, and now it's 13 weeks. Again, it's developed. You're doing more. There's much more involved with it, and dogs, I imagine, exactly the same, doesn't it? It's becoming more professional.
It's been 13 weeks for quite a long time, but they are now pushing for professional qualifications. And that's part of the reason that I'm here where we are this week, to try and build some qualifications. But, you know, I mean, how many people are on a helicopter when it's taken off or on a mission? How many people are on board?
So it depends on the model. That's different right across the country. And in fact, it's different here in Devon as well, because we've got two helicopters.
Yeah.
Broadly speaking, in our North Devon helicopter, we have three people. So that's two to critical care paramedics and a pilot. Okay. And in Exeter, we have two critical paramedics, a pilot and a doctor. So that's our model. You can look right around the country and see variations on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
You talked about it earlier. How much, obviously you've got the clinical side, but you mentioned the aviation side as well. So, you know, how much training do you get on that? What's your involvement in that?
I mean, yeah,
if something, God forbid, was to happen to the pilot, do they give you the skills to bring it down?
So those are events that have happened, you know, thankfully, not here in the UK, but certainly around the world, there have been single pilot helicopters where the pilot has become incapacitated. And you're very much then in the hands of the crew that are left, and their ability to be able to perform the actions that we're trained to do to bring the helicopter back down to ground. Now,
so you do get that training.
It will be a very dramatic landing.
So not only are you landing the aircraft, you're also saving the life of the pilot in your paramedic manner. I tell you, see, I refer back to the hero.
Hero, absolute hero. Yeah.
You'll be one CPR with one hand, joystick in the other.
Yeah. I don't know whether you saw it, Nigel, but there's already been a bit of banter about helicopters not being real aircraft from our very good friend Scott Bateman.
Jumbo jet pilot.
But you do have some level of training on how to operate the very expensive piece of kit that you're sat in.
So mostly our training and our role when we're operational is around navigation and around communication and eyes out for hazards, not the flying. Did I mention we've got a new helicopter? Don't do that. We've got a brand new helicopter in Devon, which is really exciting. It kind of looks a bit like our existing helicopter, but it's bigger. And it's much more clever, and it's got a much bigger computer. But of course, what that means is it requires a lot more training. So that's what we're doing at the moment.
How does a charity make a decision on what? How does it? Can you hear me? Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How does a charity make a decision that not that they need another helicopter? Obviously, if the need's there, you get one. But how do you decide what model? Do you go to helicopter supermarket? Is it on Amazon? what do you do?
So we've got guys in Devon Air Ambulance who, you know, that's their responsibility. So we've got a flight operations director, and we've got, you know, senior pilots, etc. You know, the charity from a finance point of view or their say, and you know, so a lot of people are involved in making the decision ultimately. Thankfully, actually, there aren't that many options. You know, there's a small, it's not like looking for a car where there are, you know, hundreds of different choices. There's a relatively small number of choices. And they all come with pros and cons, of course. Now, what we've stuck with is the same manufacturer. And some of the benefits of that are around things like engineering and you know, that kind of thing. So that's, I think, part of the decision that we had. I mean, the reason we've got it is not because we've got a third helicopter. It's because we needed to replace our oldest helicopter. So the oldest one is being sold. So we won't have three helicopters. We will have two once the new one becomes operational.
Scotty Bateman is suggesting something. Well, first of all, how much does it cost?
How much does what
helicopter cost? The hardware, so to speak. Any idea?
So with all the kit, our new one.
Yes,
I think it's up to about €8 million.
Okay, pretty.
I think. It's around about €8 million.
See, I don't think that, because it used to be about that a while back. So that's good. And so there's Scotty asking if you want to have a swap. He'll be a paramedic for the day and you can fly jumbo jets and stuff.
I'm sure he's reasonable. A better job at that swap role than me.
Right. I got a bone to pick with you, because Dave and I are law-abiding citizens, all right? And we see that sometimes you flagrantly disregard the law. And I'm going to show you this picture here that I want people to see. Did you take this picture, Nigel, or was this one of your colleagues?
You know me, I'm not that good at, putting stuff up on Twitter or observing these kind of things. But even I thought it.
it's brilliant.
That's quite a good question, actually, arises out of that. I mean, if you see a bit of land, do you land on it? Or do you think, oh, crikey, who does that belong to? I guess if it's a medical emergency, you can pretty much do what you like, can't you?
So it's a little bit like blue light driving. You know, the our pilots have got exemptions to what normal pilots would have. So we can fly in places and land in places where civilian, if you like, pilots wouldn't really be allowed to land. We've got limits. There are some limits what we can and can't do, but essentially we can land in lots of very small, tight.
See, this is interesting because there's so many questions around this now. First of all, is there a bit of a healthy competition between the police, especially the police pilots and the air ambulance pilots? Because the air ambulance pilots get to land in dodgy places and the police pilots don't. And yet I know from experience there's quite a few of them on either side are sort of special forces, ex-pilots and military pilots and that side of thing. So we get the best, the creme de la creme of pilots. And so you know you're pretty well looked after, I guess, don't you, Nigel?
Do you know what? We really are. Our pilots. I mean, I hope they're not watching this because
you don't want to show any weakness.
I don't really want them to know quite how I feel about them, but you know, they are amazing. They land us on scene when we really need to get to scene, in places where, you know, even I, after 11 years, will sometimes think, crikey, how did we land there? You know, when we're flying sometimes in, you know, 50 knot winds and howling gales, horizontal rain, and we're landing on Dartmoor, we're landing on beaches, we're landing on motorways, we're landing in fields next to streams, in people's gardens, on sport fields, you know, you name it, playing part.
And it's the downdraft as well you've got to be careful of, haven't you, with bits flying about.
So what we can't do is, you know, go to an emergency and then create an additional emergency just by turning up. We have to be really careful. That downdraft that you just mentioned, you know, can cause a lot of damage. It will blow obstacles across roads and across beaches and across, you know, fields and play parks, and really can, you know, could injure people. So we have to be very observant and look out for these things and make our approach accordingly, so we don't do that.
Cool.
So now and then you must get so I'm going to be a complete child about this. Now and then you must get a good tailwind. So what's the fastest speed you think you've ever done in a helicopter?
So I think I've gone over 200 miles an hour.
Was that downwards?
Yeah.
And were you upside down?
So you're right. I mean, you add the wind speed to your flight, and if it's on your nose, that's going to slow you down. If it's on your tail, it speeds you up. And if it's really windy and it's on your tail, you rattle along at a good old speed.
Yeah.
Have you gone? Answer that question from Julie. Have you had any real scary moments in the helicopter? You must have.
Well,
that you're able to admit.
I've had lots, but my pilots will say we've not had any, because
all under control.
Even when I'm feeling pretty scared, they're still within their comfort zone.
You haven't even got missiles coming at you. What are you worried about?
Now you're saying like our pilots.
I was in the police helicopter and the skids came down and it was a bit windy and whatever, and he went ding ding, and they have loads of little sayings like the observer said, yeah, that was a nice landing, especially the first and the third one. They do take the mick out of each other.
I think the time when you are most concerned is when your visibility's gone. So, you know, suddenly you're in clouds. That's not particularly nice, basically. And I think the other times are when you are landing, when you can't actually land permanently on the ground and you're in the hover and you're having to get out on a sloping ground.
Yeah.
Helicopters have limits. They can't land on slopy ground. And so what we do is a light skid landing where you're touching either one side of the skid or the two front ends of the skid into a hillside.
Oh, that is creepy.
Yeah. Oh.
Hello?
Oh.
Hello?
Yeah, we're back. We're back. And it literally noses into that incline. Is that right, Nigel?
Yeah, it really does. That is a really great way of getting close to a casualty without having to land some way off and then make your way on foot, because our bags are really heavy.
And obvious danger is the rotor blades, which are going to be, depending on how the angle of the land is, that pilot's got to judge. I mean, they must be able to judge it all right, but blimey.
I think it always looks a lot more amazing than what it really is. What you've got to remember is that they can't fly that close to danger. You know, they've got to have that, you know, big tolerance of safety. So whilst it looks really impressive to us, they will say, do you know what? It was well within the safety tolerances.
And that goes to that question. Is there a maximum weed spin?
Yeah, so there's a maximum speed for at starting up and shutting down. There's no maximum speed for flying. So maximum start up and shut down speed is 50 knots.
Now, is that miles per hour tend to be higher slightly? Is that like 70 knots or is that more like 40 knots, 40 miles an hour, or is it, do you know?
So it's higher. So it's about 65 miles an hour.
All right, okay.
So in a really high wind, as the propellers are going around,
they
start off slow and they get up, they increase in speed. At the time that they're going around quite slow, in a very high wind, they can be blown up and down. What can happen in theory is the rotor blade could strike the rear of the helicopter.
Right.
And
as you're starting up and as you're shutting down.
Oh, I see, of course, because they're really,
You can fly in, theoretically, 100 mile an hour winds, theoretically. Mm. Bearing in mind, of course, the stronger the wind, the more... the more you need your vomit bowl.
And do you get air sick still on certain occasions, especially when your head's down and you're doing stuff?
It can happen. Of course, you do get a bit used to.
I'll be back in one second.
You build up a resistance to it, but it's not without. I did some recent flying on our new helicopter on a particularly windy day, and I spent my first hour facing the rear, and I really did feel quite sick. But now, of course, normally speaking, when we're in the rear of the helicopter, we're looking after, a poorly patient. Yeah. And that focus on what you're doing means that you don't really feel sick at all.
No, of course. Right. I get that, because your mind is elsewhere. All your brain activity is on that patient. Now, I've just removed Dave because I think he's either been carjacked or he's taking a phone call or something. So we're just looking at the roof of his car. But what I want to say is, now, Because obviously, I know with Francis, and I know Dave, when he's on the way to the job, you're running. You and you're back in the room. Sorry, I don't know what's happening. It keeps nipping out. And you can hear me okay?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, I'm with you.
Nige?
Yeah, good, I'm good. With you.
So have you got a process of going through your mind of preparing yourself, especially when it comes in and it's sounding bad and it sounds like you're the first ones on scene, you know, and to what you are going to deal with when you get there? I mean, you could have several patients and a car crash, you know, pile up or whatever, various. And have you done it long enough now where you just think, right, I'll just go through my system in my head, and you're quite comfortable about that sort of thing?
I think things like multiple casualties, thankfully, it's not a really common incident.
Sorry about that.
So, yeah.
Hello, Dave. Right. So they happen, of course they happen, but they're not happening every week, thank goodness. And so I think it's fair to say, even after 10 or 11 years that I've been on operational, if I'm going to a multi-casualty incident, I'm really focusing on what I'm going to be doing before I get there.
Right.
And when you go to a major incident, we follow the same procedures as all ambulances will follow, and as all you know, police officers and fire and rescue guys will follow. We follow a set routine, don't we, in terms of first on scene, the communication, the information gathering, and your first priority. So they're the same pretty much for all of us.
Sure. I mean, that's interesting now. And it's the simplest thing, isn't it? It's the simplest thing in your mind as you're going through. So, because now, you know, my interesting thing is when you were first time solo, can you remember that time? And going to those first jobs. And of course, everyone looks at you thinking, you know, everything, and brilliant.
Even us as the police, don't we? Thank God the ambulance is here. Stand back now. Woo!
Yeah. We can stop pretending we know what we're doing, Dave. That's it.
I think there is a big amount of pressure that's put on you. And I think particularly I've felt that turning up wearing a red flight suit puts an additional pressure on you.
Yeah,
everyone thinks it's all okay when you turn up, and as we know, you know, we can't perform miracles. It's not always going to be okay.
Oh, you can, Nigel. You can. I mean, and is there one? I know these are things that people want to know as well, because they tend to ask me: is there one particular incident that you're particularly proud about, or that looked particularly that it was everything was so bad and yet it came right in the end? Is there anything that sticks out in your mind, or does it all blend into one where you are just ploughing through this huge number of emergencies you attend to over 11 years? You must have dealt with so many.
I think that the perception is that we're saving lives every day, and we're not saving lives every day. Hopefully what we're doing every day is we're helping people and we're making their bad day better. And we're easing their suffering, we're easing their pain, and we're coming up with the solution they need. But we're not saving lives every day, but we do save lives from time to time. And, you know, I can recall a number of incidents where, you know, I think, and they're not necessarily the ones that you read about in the newspaper or on, you know, on the local news. They're the ones that nobody really knows about apart from you and your colleagues and the family.
Well, we know that situation, don't we, Dave, where some of our best jobs are never heard about by anybody.
Yeah, very well. I mean, you're used to it now, Nigel, because you've done the job for a very long time. But there must have been points in your career where you think,
my God, the human body was able to withstand that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The human body is incredible.
Yeah.
And equally, there must be jobs that you go to where you think, oh, they'll be all right. And actually, they're not, because the human body couldn't cope with what looked perhaps less serious than some other jobs that you've been to. And you walk away thinking, crikey, I thought we had that one, and it didn't quite work out.
So, you know, there's limits to what we can find out when we're at sea. You know, we don't have the luxury of the diagnostic equipment that they have in hospital. And so we are often working off of, you know, our clinical assessment of the patient. And, you know, we can get that wrong, but we work with what we've got in front of us. Mm. Every month we have a whole day assessing our patients from the month before and reviewing them at a clinical governance meeting. And we find out the actual images of their scans and their x-rays and their blood tests, etc.
Well, on the back of that, Nigel, you must see, again, you must have seen stuff throughout your entire career that, you know, even me as a police officer, I can get to a scene and actually, if I don't want to look at the gooey stuff, I don't have to, but you don't have a choice. And you see the body sometimes in situations that it really shouldn't be in. And we all know the toll that can take on the human brain. So, you know, how do you deal with that? How does your previous employer, the ambulance service, deal with that? And how does your current employer deal with that? Is there much more support nowadays than there used to be, or is there more they can do?
Cool. I think there's more support now than there's ever been. And there's a lot of support available. For me, and of course, this is all individual, but I think that I get a lot of support from my peer group. And I think, you know, you're nodding there, and that's probably not a surprise to you, because, you know, working with your mates, your colleagues, I think is the best way to just open up and work what you do, because they understand it best.
Yeah, totally.
There's loads of questions I need to ask you. First of all, do you have Hazel, I think it was, do you have an issue with people with the mobile phones trying to get in your way and things like that, getting something on the next YouTube?
Yes. Yep. It happens.
And do you sort of step back into them by mistake sometimes when you're busy?
I can't say I've ever done that, Harry, but I like your thinking. No, so I have asked people to stop.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that they will stop.
But you sort of shame them into it almost, really.
Yeah, more often than not, you know, I'm unaware of it until, you know, someone mentions it later and it's all over the internet. And it's one of the less pleasant things, I think, that, you know, we've done so well, haven't we, with technology and with, you know, with mobile phones, and they're great. And they help us a lot. That technology helps us a lot in our work, but equally, you know, it can be used for you know, for things like videoing people on their worst day. Yeah. And I don't like that.
Oh, Dave's gone. I don't know what's happening with it. Now, this is a good question, Jackie. Jack from Jackie, because this helps in the police and our sort of medical stuff and on the armed response and that side of things, we found really good. Can you see that? So have you found that the doctors and paramedics that have been in the forces have brought some really good information to the air ambulance thing? Where do they get, where are your latest techniques updated from?
So a lot of our trauma care in the last probably 10 or 12 years, a lot of the finer developments have come from the military experience. And so we've got a lot to be thankful for, because a lot of our military medics also work in the civilian world, and where they see things work well in operations, in military operations, they've been brought back into the civilian world, and it has almost changed beyond recognition our trauma care here in Civvy Street. Yeah.
Right, there's a question. Have you had a patient so that their fear of flying sort of overcomes the pain that they're in and they want to get to hospital with? It might not be a life-threatening thing. It might be a situation you're in the middle of Dartmoor, for example, and it's the, you know, where they a flight is a lot easier than a...
Can you imagine, okay, you are the patient. You are the patient because you've just crashed your aeroplane or your helicopter. Or you've crashed your paraglider.
Is that like getting straight back onto the bicycle sort of thing?
You know, and we do go to those. I've been to several aeroplanes and paragliders and hang gliders, etc. And, you know, I guess for them, that must be not the the most welcome sight, having fallen out of the sky.
Is it quite claustrophobic, I think? Well, you know, when you get shunted in there.
Yeah.
If you're conscious enough to know your surroundings.
I think it probably is a little bit for some people. So the people we fly are the really sick people. We don't fly people unless they're really sick.
Yeah.
I think if they're really sick, they kind of understand that, you know, this is just something they need to go through. And if somebody's fear of flying is stopping them from us putting them in a helicopter, then they're probably not that sick.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. I mean, because do you ever get there was one here I wanted to actually see. Biggest triggers, helis. You'll probably have to. Oh, right. There's someone there who said you'd have to sedate them to get them into a helicopter. They probably would be if you're in a helicopter anyway, I suggest. But it is. There's a few people asking that. I mean, my thing is claustrophobia, and I think Dave's yours was as well, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I think I'd be all right with it. But then, you know, when you think about it, you'll see Nigel's cheerful little face looking at you, and then realise that life isn't so bad after all. You're in good hands.
There you go.
How's it been with the masks and things?
Yeah, it's been really challenging. It's been really challenging. And you know, everything I say about the masks and about the PPE will be what all healthcare workers are faced with.
Yeah.
You know, so what you can't see is the expression on your face, your body language. Much of your body language is focused on your face, and when you are either working with colleagues at an incident and you're wanting to communicate with them, to remove that facial expression reduces your weight of communicating quite significantly. And of course, then when you're talking with relatives and friends of the patient, it's very difficult to express your empathy without that facial expression as well. On top of that, of course, I mean, you just saw a surgical mask there, which is the lowest level of mask in that picture. So you know, we, on top of that, we'll wear an FFP3 or a face shield. We wear powered hoods, which are like a positive pressured hood, and you know, all in one white suit, two layers of gloves. It can be quite difficult to hear each other, for me, I think communicating is really difficult, but the worst thing of all is when you are, you know, having to convey bad news to relatives, and you're doing so in a very sterile kind of way, and it's not very nice.
Yeah.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, that body language thing is huge. I mean, we're supposed to wear them at work, but then your dog is like, well, I can't see you communicating with me anymore. So it does throw up some interesting things, doesn't it? I mean, I find myself even walking into the supermarket and smiling at the cashier thinking, she can't see I'm smiling. It's a strange world. We could end up with a generation that loses that form of communication if we're not sure. Guys, I'm going to have to leave you because the weather has taken a turn for the worst and my reception is absolutely appalling here. But Nigel, it's been an absolute pleasure to meet you, and I'm going to leave you in Harry's capable hands.
It's been an absolutely pleasure to meet you as well, Dave.
Thank you, Dave. You take care. Cheers, my friend. Yay! Right, what I wanted to say about Dave. Right, this is it.
I find that amazing. It's very interesting, isn't it, when he was saying that the dogs also find their handlers wearing masks.
I know, he said it.
Not thought about that at all.
He said it as if we should know it, and because it is so natural to them. It's that they said. I mean, and I know he said in the past, and other dog handlers is basically the dogs can feel along that line. It's an extension of them. They can see if you're stressed and you're thinking, oh no, where's this track? The dog is far more likely to lose the track because it can sense that dad at the end or mum at the end of the line is thinking it's not good. And the dog gets stressed. It gets, you know, it gets frustrated. It's just a fascinating subject. I mean, they just eat, live and breathe dogs. It's amazing. So, of course, you as the air ambulance wouldn't have had dogs on your, or do you have a woman with a dog? You're there. Do you put the, obviously, if anything, you can put the dog into the hands of a friend or even a member of public, but I imagine you avoid at all costs trying to put, you know, because you don't know how it's going to behave, do you?
No, we wouldn't put, I can't imagine us ever putting a dog in the helicopter. I think there has been one incident in my whole career where we found ourselves considering it, but we didn't do it. And you're right, you have to use those people around you to the general public are amazing, aren't they? You know, at a time when somebody needs help, there's always people that will step up and help. And you hear a lot about things about people not doing so. And equally, you know, people don't, but you also get people who will. And so I think it's so important. People come and help us out all the time.
It's so important to remember that, Nigel, because I especially get to see or got to see the worst part of the public generally. It's usually when they were shouting at me or when they had just committed a crime or whatever. And I used to do a lot of Duke of Edinburgh Awards sort of stuff. Well, still do really. And you see, actually, do you know what? There's some good youngsters about coming through the ranks, and the future's safe. There's some really decent people, and those that stop to help people in their greatest hour of need, and there's quite a few of them. Usually they're around. Which, right, let's come to this very quickly because I don't want to miss this out, and that is Learn to Live. Can you explain this very quickly to your adoring public right now?
Sure. So I'm sure you can explain it better than me. We've both been part of it for a very long time, and you've been involved in it for longer than me. But Learn to Live is a road safety initiative that is delivered to students of the age around about 17, 18, right across, I was going to say Devon, but it's actually Devon, Cornwall, and many other counties now. But within Devon and Cornwall, I think I'm right in saying we get to speak to about 12,000 students.
Yeah, it is about 12,000.
And it's a presentation. It's quite a long presentation. It lasts for about an hour and a half, and it's delivered by an incredible group of people who I've got to know over the years, and Harry has as well. a relatively small group of people who are made up of all of the emergency services and also the parents of some children that have been killed on the roads. And so in their memory, often the parents are putting themselves forwards to help get the message out there. Road traffic collisions are one of the incidents that I find probably hardest to deal with. You know, when I get home at the end of a shift, when I've had to deal with somebody that has been either very seriously injured or killed on the road, I feel very sad about that, because these are things that are preventable. And there's no such thing, I feel, as, you know, a road accident. You know, these collisions occur because somebody has chosen to drive in such a way that has meant that somebody has, you know, suffered as a result.
And you do find, and I think it really gets into the hearts of the youngster, they're just about to start driving, or they're just being driven by boyfriends or girlfriends. And it's to empower them to think that actually I can do something about this. You know, I'm feeling unsafe. And that's the thing. And it's an incredible thing. And I've always said it's much better than giving just speeding tickets out to people. It's a bit too late then. Few questions here, Nigel. First of all, night flying. Do you night fly?
Yes, we do. We've been night flying since 2016. We currently finish at 2 o'clock in the morning. And we finish at 2 o'clock in the morning because of a couple of big reasons, really. After 2 o'clock in the morning, there is still work to be done, but it's the workload drops off quite a bit at that time of the day. Of course, there's a cost associated with it. We have a vision of providing an air ambulance service in Devon 24 hours a day. So we're currently flying 7 days a week, every day of the year, two helicopters and covering 19 hours. So we've just got to make up those remaining 5 hours. At some point, we will do so. Flying at night, it comes with its own challenges. We use night vision goggles and various other lighting equipment. But it's only been a few years for me, so it's still relatively new to me.
Incredibly testing. I mean, you must get an idea of a lot of places. Like, I see you landing in Torbay quite a lot, and you'll clearly think, well, actually, there's some favourite spots here we've used before, or whatever. But it's just knowing where the overhead wires are and things. Yes, you've got maps, but you could always be tired and not quite be up to it, you know, that day or whatever, because and it's those human things that come in. You just cannot lose concentration once, can you?
No, absolutely. You know, so our mapping system is really state of the art. It's great. So we can see where most wires are and wind farms, etc. But do you know what? When a new wind farm goes up, our mapping system won't update immediately. It might take a few days. So especially we go to lots of farms, you know.
Yeah.
We're a very rural county, and the wires that get, you know, stretched from one barn to the next, they're not on our mapping system. So you really have to look at it.
Do you think the pilots are ever tempted to go through the blades if they get really quick? Sensible question instead is, somebody said, Debbie, Harry, why is it claustrophobic inside a helicopter? Because certainly the older ones, I think, Nigel, maybe the bigger one might be different, is that sometimes the head end would be quite close to the ceiling of the helicopter as it narrows at the back. Is that right, or has that changed now?
So you've just described our current helicopters. The new helicopter has got, it's bigger. So there's a lot more room in both lengthwise, widthwise, and heightwise.
Oh, so you can work on them easier as well. You can get around them much easier.
Yeah. So I guess claustrophobia is a very personal thing, isn't it? So what's claustrophobic for one person won't be for somebody else. And I suppose it's very personal. But I can see how some people might think that it is.
Yeah, yeah. Calv is, he's us, he's ex-military, I believe. With an armed officer accompanying high risk. We certainly do in the air, in the police helicopters. I probably think it, I don't think it probably has ever happened in my memory, Nigel. Necessity wasn't there, as I imagine. Is that right? If you say you've got someone who's...
Yeah, we would do. We would, for sure, but only in exceptional circumstances. So it would have to be a VIP of some description. So it would be, let's say, a member of the royal family or a senior member of government, I would imagine, who needed an armed officer would...
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. And people think, because I worked on the VIP side of things, people think, well, why should they get any more? Because... where the protection officer is actually protecting the position they're in, not the human being. So yes, the human being comes with the position, but it's considered by the country that it would be a huge loss to the public overall, the country overall, and that's why they get protection sort of thing. So there you go. There's loads of stuff coming in. I was just after a really bad accident talking involving many vehicles. Just people, it's quite nice to see people just expressing their feelings and things. An incredible amount of people grateful and glad you're there. Do you know what? It's just really nice to know that in this country, with all its complaints and things like that, and that if we need help, we can get it. And it's like the NHS, and it's a bit like policing. Even though we've lost a lot of the stuff through austerity and things, and as the queues might be slightly longer for the bit. If you are dying or you are in dire need of assistance, it is there immediately. And that is amazing stuff, isn't it, really?
It really is. And, you know, when you compare, for example, the sort of response you get here in the UK to maybe in the States, and the difference being, you know, a bill, maybe... £70,000-£80,000 bill for a helicopter taking you to hospital. Yeah. You know, and in this country, it's free.
There you go.
Difference just, you know, a few thousand miles away, what a difference it is.
And somebody actually said, I don't know if you've heard this, they said, it would cost me 30p to use the toilet in town, but I can get a brand new heart transplant for free. So it just shows what it's like. And is there a reason why a smaller aircraft is used as opposed to the Merlin helicopter? I know the Merlin helicopter, I happen to have flown one, you know, is a massive downdraft on those things. And the Coast Guard tend to use those, don't they, Nigel? Do they, I think?
I think they use the Augustas, I think.
On that.
But I don't know. Do you know what?
No, you are right. They are a different shape.
Speaking about helicopters, I'll be honest. But if you think the smaller the helicopter, to a degree, the smaller the place we can land, and the bigger the helicopter is, the bigger the space we need. And so, the bigger the helicopter, the more we limit ourselves about where we can land. And so, it's always a bit of a balancing act about having the right sized helicopter to be able to have the endurance to fly in the conditions that you need to fly. We've got to have two engines because we're flying over towns and cities, and you can't do that with a single engine. So there's things that you have to have to perform the role. You also don't want to, by the choice of your aircraft, limit where you can go.
No, because you don't. It's not necessarily numbers you need in the back of a large aircraft like that, is it? Is you don't need. I mean, large aircraft like a Merlin, for example, you can fit a lot of people in there, and yet most of the time you're bringing nobody or somebody back, just one person. I think we've got to end. We've got to end it. We've got to end and leave them wanting more, Nigel. It is 4 minutes past five, and I think that one's a recap there from Mick. The Air Ambulance does a fantastic job, shouldn't need to be a charity, but I disagree because, and this is a good point to say, please think of your local Air Ambulance and to donate to, because in these days, this day and age, there's less charity money is being given and being collected because of all the COVID side of things. So please, support your local Air Ambulance, and if you can't think of one, do it to the Devon, Southwest Devon Air Ambulance. because they need it. And we don't really want it to be a charity because the government will spoil everything and give you a really low budget. And but Nigel, thank you so much for coming. It's been amazing. Really appreciated you coming. And we'll leave it there. All right.
Thank you, Harry, for inviting me on. It's been an absolute honour and privilege.
Brilliant stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you, buddy. And just everyone out there, if you could, if you use YouTube, really good play. I'm always on YouTube now to find out exactly what's happening, as opposed to the news and all that sound now. But if you could look up Frontline Chat, and here we go. If you could look up my friend.